Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode features an hour with Julia Alvarez speaking at the Arlene Stitzer Concert Hall in 2014. In this talk, Alvarez takes us on her life's journey, which serves as a critical story for so many who have lived through the second half of the 20th century. Julia Alvarez was born in the U.S. in 1950. When she was 3 months old, her family moved back to the Dominican Republic. A decade later, they were forced out when her father took part in a coup attempt on the dictator Rafael Trujillo. Alvarez emphasizes the power of story to empower, but also to help maintain a sense of identity in a foreign country. Alvarez is humble and humorous, and her talk ranges from revolutions to the schoolyard, from the civil rights movement to the importance of librarians, and references the work from writers as diverse as Toni Morrison, Dave Eggers, Grace Paley, and Spike Lee. Here's Julia Alvarez at the Arlene Stitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. I've felt welcome since I stepped off that plane weary last night. Happy to be back in Portland. And I'm glad that, maybe you aren't, that it was raining. Because now I know that Portlanders, is that what they call you? Portlanders? That they're not just complainers. It really does rain all the time, at least once a day. So it's wonderful. It is wonderful to be here. And we came from Vermont, where it's just been the most horrid winter. So this feels balmy, tropical. So my talk today is about the power of story to change the world one imagination at a time. In the spring of 1991, when my first novel was published, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, I was sent on a book tour. I was surprised. You see, I had started writing in those times where there was no such thing as a book tour. In fact, books were just beginning to have authors' photos when I started writing. And it was a few more years before those author photos became glamour shots. Erica Jong at the top from Fear of Flying, with that tousled blonde hair falling sexily over one eye, mouth parted open, prefiguring the models of Victoria's Secret. Then John Irving, with sweaty muscles, hair dripping with sweat, looking like he just wrestled down his enormous bestseller, The World According to Garp. And then even poets. Galway Kinnell, well, Erica was a poet too. Galway Kinnell, Book of Nightmares, looking like he'd just come in from chopping wood to write a poem about it. And even Raymond Carver, whom we all thought of as this hulking, bumbling guy from the hard-drinking, hard-scrabble world of his down-and-out characters, looking like a seething guy on the make, ready to pounce on you. But by the time Garcia Girls came out, we had authors' photos, we had book tours, and one of the mandatory stops was always Powell Books at Portland, Oregon. Thank you. I had never been to a department store of just books. The only comparison was when we arrived in New York City in 1960 from the Dominican Republic, and my father took me to the New York Public Library, the one on 42nd Street with the lions and the grand steps leading up to the entrance. I had never been in a cathedral of books. That's the only comparison I could make in my mind for such a grand structure. I wasn't yet a reader, but I was awed, especially when my papi, with typical exaggeration, told me that this library had a copy of every book that had ever been written by an Americano. I think he was confusing it with the Library of Congress. Oh, and just in case you think we were this intellectual reading family and this was our first sightseeing stop in Nueva York, our first outing had actually been to Herald Square with Mommy to see Macy's, the biggest store in the world. So anyhow, here I am back in Portland, 23 years and over a dozen books later, except I'm not good at math, and I just learned that there are at least 20. But here I am, and instead of at the very beginning of my public writing career, I'm now, well, somewhere towards the end, to quote Diana Adhill's wonderful memoir about old age. These days, I'm taking stock of what I've learned by practicing this craft over the course of a lifetime. And this is what we do at our age. We take stock. A lot has changed. And I hope I have grown and matured as a writer. But one thing that hasn't changed is my faith in the power of stories. Looking back, even before I came into English or became a reader or wanted to be a writer, stories were helping me find my way to the person I would become, the writer who stands before you today. I grew up in the 50s in the dictatorship of Trujillo in the Dominican Republic. It was a nightmare world, a world of terror and monitoring and secret police, a world where people disappeared, ideas were censored, where owning books made you suspect as an intellectual and a troublemaker. And here we have, to change the mood, the image of the dictator, Trujillo, the dictator, who controlled, iron control of the country. But one thing the dictator could not repress was the irrepressible need of the human creature for stories. Though every publishing, every media outlet, television, radio publishing was under the control of the dictator and his secret police, still the stories came out through what people popularly called Radio Bimba, Radio Big Mouth. Ours was not a literary culture, but an oral culture, a storytelling culture. Stories, stories. What a wealth of stories people told them all the time. Years later, when I attended a graduate program in creative writing, I would realize that all that I was being taught about character and plot and timing and rhythm and lyricism and metaphor, I had learned in my homeland, in many cases, by people who could not read or write or had minimal book learning. It was an important discovery for me to make as a young writer. Spike Lee said in an interview that one of the great lessons in his life was that you can learn things from people who are dumber than you, or really, you think they're dumber than you. So, as I said, I was not a reader. I was a terrible student, flunked every grade through fifth grade. My real education happened when I got home from school and re-entered my large, colorful, complex, diverse, extended familia, full of characters, full of storytellers. You've heard the saying that it takes a village to raise a child. My extended family amounted to a small village. My father's family, my father was the youngest of 25 kids. The first wife had 10 kids, and then she died, amazingly not in childbirth. And then the second wife had 15 kids, and my father was the youngest of those 15. So here is the obligatory Sunday family gathering with abuela seated in the center with a little black hairband. And this was before the time of telephoto lens. So when the photographer would come, every once in a while, the little guy that put the black cape over his head, he arranged people, took a photo, then another group came, took a photo, and they ended up cobbling them together to get the whole family. So you can imagine how many storytellers we had. Only once can I remember falling captive to a book. not a dull, censored dictatorship school book, but one my Aunt Titi gave me, and it was called The Arabian Nights. I read and reread it, poring over the captivating pictures. Instead of the usual pale, blonde, blue-eyed princesses, the cover showed a girl with dark eyes and dark hair, a girl who could have been Dominican. This girl, Scheherazade, lived in a kingdom ruled by a cruel sultan. Every night, this sultan had a girl brought to him, and by dawn, she would be killed. A practice not unlike our dictator, by the way, but not that I knew that back then. But the night before her own beheading, Scheherazade, that was the girl's name, began telling the sultan stories. Sinbad the sailor, Ali Baba and the 40 thieves, Aladdin and his magic lamp. She had spent years reading in her father's library, learning the art of storytelling, why apprenticeship is important. And so she knew how to work the story so that at dawn, the time for her execution, she'd be at a cliff-hanging moment. Enthralled, the sultan would spare her one more night in order to hear the ending of the story. The clever Scheherazade would finish that story and then start a whole new story and be at another cliffhanging moment when the sun came up. Night after night after night, over the course of 1,001 nights. And what happened? The sultan fell in love with Scheherazade, and this love healed his heart. He repented his evil ways. Scheherazade had saved not only herself, but the sultan, and also all the women in her kingdom. This was a really important story for me to read. It put in my head a little piece of luminous information that stories have power, that they can transform us and save us. When I was 10 years old, my family was forced to flee the country because of my father's involvement in a plot against the dictator. We had to leave everything behind, our language, our homeland, our familia. But I brought the large, expansive, liberating story of Scheherazade in my head. We landed in New York City, August 1960, and Lady Liberty, that Papi told us about, would welcome us, the home of the brave and the land of the free. She even had a poem on her pedestal, which later I came to really appreciate. August 1960, the civil rights movement was just getting underway. Latino literature, multicultural literature, bilingual education were unheard of. In the playground, a group of bullies that you heard about, Andrew told you, taunted my accent, called me names, told me to go back to where I had come from, but we couldn't go back. My father would be killed. We might be killed. We had escaped a horrible dictatorship to the land of the free and the home of the brave, but I did not find this new country a very welcoming place. I felt homesick and lost and scared in this new culture and language. So this is Lady Liberty, not very happy with her Americans. And I take this picture sometimes when I talk to young kids, middle school kids, high school kids, talking about, you know, where does this prejudice, this othering, how does it happen? And I show them this picture because of the generations. You look at the little girl. She's got a really open, sweet face. She's just in a Halloween costume. She doesn't know to leave people out. And already a few years older brother, look at his pose and his snarl and how his arms are crossed. And where did he get that? Look at Grandpa. Same face, same posture. So we learn this stuff. And sometimes it just comes to us. And you know, how do we escape it? But I, instead of falling apart, I landed. I touched ground in the place I had been searching for. What happened was a wonderful sixth grade teacher. She gave me a list of books. She sent me to the library. A librarian helped me. I checked out the books and took them home and read them. I brought them back and checked out some more. I was becoming a reader. New York, 1960, a sixth grade teacher, a library, a librarian. They put books in my hands. What an amazing world this was. What freedom came with reading. You could go back to olden times. You could go to a whole other country. You could go to the future. What's more, the world of books was a truly welcoming place. No warnings posted on the cover. Not for spics, not for blacks, not for girls. Everyone was welcome. Come on in. My favorite writers seem to be saying, they don't want you there. Come on in. And here they are. Yeah, there's Jane Austen, George Eliot, Emily Dickinson, favorites as I became a reader in high school and college. And it really did feel like there was this place I could go to. I entered. I found a portable homeland, the table set for all. I found what we had come looking for in the United States of America between the covers of books, the grand democracy of the world of the imagination where everyone was welcome. My sixth grade teacher not only encouraged my reading, she told me to write down all those little stories I was telling. The aunts and uncles, tías and tíos, boy and girl cousins, primos and primas, I was missing so much. Write them all down. Teopercio with his long, straggly beard and his one glass eye that spent the night in a glass of water and his extra sixth finger. It was just a joint, but he told us it had been cut off so he could be normal. Write him down. Oh, Balbina and her stories of Ciguapas. A tribe of beautiful women who only came out at night to hunt for food, and no one could ever track them down because they had a secret. Their feet were on backwards, so their footprints were always in the opposite direction of where they had come from. Write them down. The taste of guavas, the smell of the ocean, the feel of the tropical sun like a warm blessing on my head. Write that down. I did. I wrote down my little stories, and everything I had lost came back. Not only that, the world around me changed as well. When my teacher read my stories out loud to the whole class, those very same bully boys who had spit at me and thrown stones in the playground and called me spic and told me to go back to where I come from turned around to look at me. Not that they got nicer, but for a moment, they actually saw me as real. Nothing human was alien to them, not even a little brown-haired, deeply tanned, skinny Hispanic girl with a heavy accent. It was my own personal Scheherazade moment, and I was ready for it because that earlier story had planted the seed of possibility in me. The imagination can save you. Now, that's a personal example of the power of stories. Some of the students today at noon asked me, well, what have been the special moments of your life as a writer? You know, how do you measure your success? And I said, well, it's deadly for a writer to be doing that because each book you have to learn how to write that book, beginner's mind. But there are moments that are really special. And this happened in New York City. My aunt Titi, who still lives there, went to the public library, and it was a nice spring day, so she went down Poets Walk. It's a walk behind the New York Public Library, and they have quotes by Whitman, and they have quotes by Emily Dickinson. And lo and behold, she got to one of them, and it was Julia Alvarez, and it was my birth year. So this was, well, I can't say she even has a cell phone now, but there weren't any cell phones. She ran and got a disposable camera from the drugstore, took a picture and sent it to me so that I finally was on that poet's walk where I never thought I would ever be on the shelf, and now I'm also on the sidewalk. And it's really a money saver because, as I told my husband, I don't want a gravestone. I don't want to be buried. You burn me. You keep some of those ashes, and then you go down to the Poets Walk, and just there's vents there so we don't have to pollute. So that's a personal example of the power of story. But a story can also enter the bloodstream of imagination of a people, of a culture, of a country, of the world, and change history. Take the example of the three Mirabal sisters from the Dominican Republic, who with their husbands started an underground movement against the Trujillo dictatorship. Patria, Minerva, and Maria Teresa, known by their code name of Las Mariposas, the butterflies, and their driver, Rufino, were brutally killed by the dictator on November 25th, 1960. But the story spread. People who had been paralyzed, they heard it through Radio Bemba first. People who had been paralyzed, Dominicans, by terror, began to join the movement. 6 months later, Trujillo was assassinated, signaling the end of a 31-year dictatorship. Many, many, you can imagine, in 31 years, many, many horrors have been perpetrated in that time. But the story of this brutal murder of three young women and their courage transformed and mobilized an oppressed nation. And it didn't stop at our borders. The story of the butterflies went on to inspire an international movement. In 1999, the United Nations declared the day of their murder, International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. And the declaration there, three young women who thought they were just working towards the liberation of one small half island have become international symbols of freedom for women and men everywhere. And I have, yes. Some, it's just moving, and I just picked six of them of this day being commemorated in different parts of the world. This is November 25th in India, here in Afghanistan, in Romania, with the names of women that have died due to violence and candles in front of them, in Spain, girls marching in Thailand, and this last one in Peru. So, yes, I believe in the power of story to transform the world. But I should add that the changes stories bring about are often so slight that often we ourselves are unaware that we come out of a great work of literature as a different person than when we began reading. A character, a situation, a charged line of poetry stir us deeply. No territory taken that we can see, no elections won, no sweeping legislation passed, and yet the huge movements that change the world begin with these small movements of the heart. As one of my favorite haikus by Isa, the Japanese haiku writer, describes it, I look into the dragonfly's eye and I see the mountains over my shoulder. We look into the dragonfly's eye and we see the mountains over our shoulders. We read, we listen to a story, and we become someone else, as simple and incredible as that. Terence, the Roman slave and playwright who freed himself with his writings, once wrote, I am a human being. Nothing human is alien to me. That could be the motto of literature. Nothing human is alien to the pen of a novelist. And when we read and when we write, nothing human is alien to us either. Reading, we enter deeply into the lives of the others. We exercise the muscles of the imagination, which are also the muscles of compassion and understanding. We make meaning. We knit ourselves into community by sharing the experience of being a human being. We find our way home to the deep sources that can sustain us as individuals and as a human family. Now, I love it when I have an article of faith that I find confirmed and affirmed in ancient wisdom. In Bruce Chatwin's The Songlines, he tells one of my favorite stories about storytelling. It turns out that 15,000 years ago, there were tribes, maybe you know about them, who lived in the northwest coast of America, half on the islands and half on the mainland. They would travel over the sea and navigate their canoes up the current from California to the Bering Strait, which they called Klin Otto. The navigators were priestesses. The words of this old woman represents a tradition 15,000 years old. And this is from Bruce Chatwin's Songlines. The old woman telling the story about those priestesses. Everything we knew about the movement of the sea was preserved in the verses of a song. For thousands of years, we went where we wanted, and we came home safe because of the song. On clear nights, we had the stars to guide us, and in the fog, we had the streams and the creeks of the sea, the streams and creeks that flow into and become Klin Otto. There was a song for going to China and a song for going to Japan, a song for the big island and a song for the smaller one. All she had to know was the song, and she knew where she was. To get back, she just sang the song in reverse. Through songs and stories, these priestesses kept important knowledge alive. They helped their tribe to navigate their way safely home. 15,000 years later, it still works. Our stories help us navigate our way back home to the circle of our shared humanity. I'm more and more convinced that as storytellers, we have an important role to play in bringing about the changes that must happen if we're going to survive as a human family on this small planet of diminishing resources. I admit I often feel helpless before the urgency and hugeness of the challenges before us. I sympathize with Stanley Kunitz, a little piece he wrote, Reflections, which he published at the age of 95. He said, in this little reflection, he says, "Sometimes I feel ashamed that I've written so few poems on political themes, on the causes that agitate me. But then I remind myself that to choose to live as a poet or a storyteller in the modern superstate is in itself a political act. To choose to live... To choose to live outside that confining box of status quo, to live in possibility, as Emily put it, Emily Dickinson, is a political act and has its own reward. You get to have its own personal reward, as well as bigger ones. You get to have a soul. But it's not enough to just save yours. Toni Morrison reminds us that the function of freedom is to free someone else. And the change that has to happen begins with the way transforming the way people see the world. It is the storyteller's job these days to change the imagination of change. So that's what concerns me these days as a storyteller. All that I've learned after four decades of practicing a calling, what kinds of stories can I tell that might help us navigate our way back to our springs where we can find the deep waters and nourish ourselves as a human family? My latest book, and I'll just tell you a little bit about it and then we'll have the Q&A, A Wedding in Haiti, The Story of a Friendship, is a nonfiction attempt to look in the dragonfly's eye and address the mountains over my shoulder. What are those mountains? The huge, difficult, turbulent history between two little countries on the same small island of Hispaniola, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The most brutal in the recent history is 1937, the murder, the massacre of 20,000 Haitians by the dictator soldiers who were living on the Dominican side of the border. It's a shameful genocide. And maybe some of you know of it from Edwige Dantecott's wonderful, powerful novel, The Farming of the Bones. But It's a shameful genocide, little known about, never properly addressed or redressed by the Dominican government or the international community, a mentality of enmity which continues to this day. So it's a huge mountainous issue. How to address it? Seamus Heaney has this wonderful poem where he says, and in one of the stanzas, he says, "History says don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme." And hope and history rhyme. So what if we step outside what history says and tell a new story that is really an old story of how we are part of a human family together? What happens when you form a friendship with the enemy? When you step outside your comfort zone and your cultural paradigm and keep a promise? So this is what this book is about, an unlikely friendship with myself and a young Haitian piti who, like many Haitians in desperate straits, crossed the border illegally to work in the Dominican Republic. He ended up at Altagracia, the project that my husband Bill Eichner and I started in the mountains of the Dominican Republic. And there's Piti, he's been cut off, but he's the one on the far right. And why they have the guitars is that in the project, it was wonderful because since I'm at Middlebury College, my students would take many of them their alternative break trips to the farm and do projects there. And one of them, a music major, brought a guitar, left it. These are young men that don't know how to read or write, but they learned how to play the guitar. We brought a second guitar. Then, like young people all over the world, they started a band. So there they are playing at Altagracia. In the interest of speeding this along, I won't do this sound clip, but here they are. And so one night, Piti, you know, he came as a boy, a young man, to work to help his family. I saw him at Altagracia. He looked sad and homesick. And so I thought, I'm going to brighten up his night. And what does the storyteller do? She tells a story. So I said, Piti, you know, I can see the future. And I see you married to this beautiful Haitian girl. You have a family. I went on to paint this beautiful picture. He just looked at me like I was crazy. Where was he going to meet a nice Haitian girl in an all-male work crew on a mountain in the Dominican Republic? I said, no, Piti, you don't understand. This is really going to happen, and I am going to be the godmother of the wedding. I will be there. So, you make an expansive gesture. You tell a story. What happens? 8 years later, in Vermont, we get a phone call from Piti. Madrina, I'm getting married in a week in Haiti. Are you coming? So, you see, stories can also get you into trouble. But we made it! And the story tells of all the illegalities and the things that we did to get there on time with the clock ticking away and only 24 hours to make it across Haiti. We thought it was a cathedral across the border. No way. So, with such huge problems to address, why write a story about one Haitian and one Dominican? Because I've listened to Scheherazade, to the priestesses navigating up the Klin Ato. I know that the way to transform the heart and the mind and the soul is through story. I know that if you look in the dragonfly's eye and see the mountains, you can see the mountains over your shoulder, that hope and history can rhyme. This is an important time for us storytellers. Whether the world acknowledges it or not, we have to awaken new possibilities in ourselves and in our readers and in our communities. It's our task as storytellers to write the world, R-I-G-H-T, one friendship, one reader, one imagination at a time. And just a couple more. This is something that came about. You know, the life, my heroes, I guess, presently are those writers that also are activists. A young example, Dave Edgars. An older example, more someone that I looked up to so much, Grace Paley. And this happened, yep, good old Grace. She'd be here with chewing gum in her little tennis shoes, barely reaching the podium. Wonderful Grace. This happened after a wedding in Haiti. A group of us of the diaspora decided that we would commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Haitian massacre. And we massed at the border. And we call ourselves, we do this now every year, Border of Lights. And we go on the border, we read poems, we sing, we tell stories, and it's amazing. It started with a core group of 20, and soon we have the whole village before us. This is on the Dominican side of the border. And the most thrilling thing was when we saw lights coming down the hills on the Haitian side, and little answering lights, and they put these floating lanterns on the river. So we're doing it again, October 4th through 6th. You're all invited to the border of the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And finally, this is Piti and his beautiful wife and the kid, just like I said, right? And now, you know, Piti knows there's a whole book about him, and people say, Piti, how does that feel, a whole book about you? And he says, well, he's not a reader. You know, he says he's not that excited. He doesn't seem that excited. What he's really excited about is how Bill, my husband, upstaged me with Piti, because Bill says, hey, you can write a novel. I can produce a CD. So with the help of my stepdaughter, who designed the cover, she's an artist, and CD Baby Online, they recorded Piti and his brothers, you'll hear them, and it's Lina, who's now part of the band. And so we're going to go out with just a few seconds of you hearing him play his CD, and you can order it on CD Baby, by the way. And the full $10 goes to him. He's very happy about this. So take it away. We better cut it. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, so you can write your questions on cards and hand them to the ushers. I've got questions, so we'll start with those and then take your questions as soon as they arrive. Question here, in your opinion, what makes a good writer?
Oh, my goodness.
We started with an easy one. It gets much worse later.
Well, that is really tough. I mean, finally, it's really what makes a good book, because I think, you know, it's not just about the writer. And, you know, you can have a writer that writes a good book and maybe the next one or the next few or never writes again that way. I think the focus is more the good book for me. And I think a good book is one that, well, changes my perception, transforms me. And I think a good writer to me is one that is willing to do that work and to sit down and have the discipline of doing that. And I think the best writers disappear. And what you have is the text. And of course, you know, we feel like we want to touch the writer, we want to get to know the writer, but it is the text. So I think a writer that does the work, and I also talk about currently the writers that I'm admiring are also writers that are really connected to community and want to be agents of the real necessary change that has to happen. And in a variety of ways. It doesn't have to be that they're out there propagandizing or anything like that, but they're able to, through their storytelling, transform the way people are thinking. That was a hard question.
What are some of the difficulties you face when you write?
Wow. It's hard work. And as I said, you can't, just because you wrote a book that worked last time, you've got to forget all that. You've got to start over. Beginner's mind, I really do believe that. It helps over the course of a lifetime of practicing that you've built up a craft. But you've got to learn how to write the book before you. And that's tough because there is no recipe. And I know people, there isn't a way to say this is the way to do it because writers are so different. But for me, discipline, showing up, is a basic thing. Many times I'm not inspired. Many times I throw things away. But if I hadn't shown up, I wouldn't have kept that agility with the language going. And at the end of the day, you shouldn't be able to tell the paragraph that took me 2 weeks to write from the paragraph that came like a dream. But I know the difference. But you show up. And I make the comparison a lot with my students to a dancer. That if you're a dancer and you don't do your bar exercises for 2 weeks and then you get inspired and go out because you hear a piece of music to dance, you're going to sprain something. And the same thing of keeping the agility, even if you're just writing in a journal, even if you're writing a blog, however you do it, to keep that limber so that you're ready for the moment when inspiration hits with the instrument that is all that craft to be able to execute it.
What is your favorite guilty pleasure when you're writing and editing a novel?
My favorite guilty pleasure? Who asked me that? I've got to put that in my writing day. Maybe I don't take enough. I mean, I take lots of little pleasurable things, but guilty pleasure? I don't know. You know, I guess I do have one where if things aren't going well, I'll pull out a good book to read. And my husband says, "Did you have a good writing day?" And I think, "Yeah, I finished that novel." I've read 20 pages of Jack Gilbert, my new favorite. So I don't know. That's lying. It makes me feel guilty because I don't have anything to show for myself. But who cares? It's not about me only, you know? It's about these wonderful storytellers and poets.
What is something surprising you have discovered in your journey of being an author?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many surprises. I mean, we were talking about this, Sydney, and I in the back that, you know, she was saying, well, you know, sometimes I don't know what I think unless I write it down, unless I write a poem. And I thought, yeah, all right. So I think often, I mean, people do it differently, but the way that I make meaning and understand reality is through creating these word things. And so I'm full of surprises all the time. In fact, you know, to go back to that first question that I felt like I was floundering in, I think one way to tell a good writer is if you keep surprising yourself. Frost said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. You got to be, the juice of it is that you're constantly learning things that you didn't know you knew through the process of writing. So I think I've really just constantly been surprising myself as a writer.
What obstacles have you encountered being a Latino writer, and how have you overcome them?
Well, when I started writing, there was no such thing as Latino writing. You heard there was no such thing as bilingual education, multicultural studies. We didn't have women's studies back then. Afro-American studies started to come in when I was in college, but not in the canon. You know, every once in a while, some cool teacher would bring in, you know, African-American poet, Langston Hughes, whatever. But there was it didn't exist. So I think the first real barrier that I encountered was internal. That even though I really, everything I was reading was saying that writing is about being a human being, I didn't see anybody on the shelf that the books that had people like me in it or were written by people like me. So internally, I didn't really believe that it could be done. That was a big surprise that I could do it. That was a big surprise to learn that I could be a writer. And first, I mean, Garcia Girls wasn't published till I was 41. So I had already spent about 20, 25 years writing with no success. I mean, it was when what we wrote about as Latino authors was considered sociology, not really part of American literature. And then came the big opening. Many of us Latina writers talk about the first big sort of green light that we got was Maxine Hong Kingston publishing The Woman Warrior, that amazing book. And we read it and we thought, this is about a Chinese American in Sacramento, but it could as well be a Dominican in Nueva York or a Mexican American in Chicago, some of the same issues. And it was beautiful. And it was so well received. And I think in the 80s began the opening of the canon. And, you know, it's been remarkable during my lifetime to see it open as much as it has. But there's still a lot of challenges out there for writers of ethnicities, even though it's, I mean, American literature now is flush with them and vibrant with them. You know, Jhumpa Lahiri, Juno Diaz, Edwige Danticat, Julie Otsuka. I don't know how many of you have read Buddha in the Attic, my last novel that I read, a real favorite. So it's changing a system. But I've seen it happen during the course of my own writing life.
This question's from Roxy. As an immigrant, I feel like I'm neither here nor there. Where is home for you?
Well, I think I talked about it a little bit with being a writer. It's the world of the imagination, which is really a blueprint, ink, we no longer use it, but a blueprint for you know, how to be as a human family. But that's really where I've been able to bring the worlds together and integrate them in a way that, because I live in Vermont, and I call it the Latino compromise state of Vermont, there aren't that many Latinos there. And then I go to the DR, and, you know, it's the other world. It's either or. The paper, the writing is where I've been able to integrate it. But the older I get, I just think that that duality or that complexity of who we all are is key. I tell my students at Middlebury that are in Alianza, the Latino Association, because they complain about being in the Latino Compromise state of Vermont for 4 years. I say, you know, they say they're constantly feeling like they have to explain themselves, they have to represent who they are. And I say, you are the bridge people. You are connecting, you know, two cultures through your being. And we're critical people. You're creating that little web that's happening. So I think, that the thing that I was taught that was really an error was that I had to choose, that it was either or. It's not either or. It's both and more.
That was Julia Alvarez speaking at the Arlene Stitzer Concert Hall in 2014. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.